Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, and welcome to the Gotcha Radio Show with your host, Mike Holt. With me in the studio today is my guest, Jamie. We'll only call him that for reasons that will become obvious as we go through the program. Jamie has done a lot of research into the Port Arthur massacre. So without any further ado, Jamie, would you like to join us and tell us the results of your research?
But basically, I was when the Port Arthur incident happened, for 18 years after the event, I was like the majority of people. He was guilty, no questions. That's what we were told in the TV, in the media. It wasn't until about 18 months ago that I was having a conversation with my mother with regards to interesting things like 9/11 and stuff like that, and she told me that my uncle Noel actually wrote a book or a presentation on the Port Arthur massacre, a prelude to the Royal Commission in 2001. And that sort of shocked me at the time, and obviously the book was suggested that Martin Bryan was innocent. And it really pricked my interest up. It sort of got me thinking and got me looking into the case. So I started investigating it, and then very quickly discovered that, yes, it looked like he was not guilty of the crimes he was accused of.
No, so, that's interesting, because a lot of people do believe that he was guilty. So, yeah, I think we need to find out what you found.
It's quite understandable for people to believe he is guilty. As I said, that's what's portrayed on the TV. It's a pretty closed case to a lot of people. So what I actually did was conduct my own personal investigation on the case. I do not consider myself a conspiracy theorist. I consider myself an investigator of conspiracy theories. So what I've done is go through various sources of information, including investigator reports, the DPP case, or the official narrative, court transcripts.
What's a DPP?
The Department of Public Prosecution. So they presented the case when he pleaded guilty, or the day of his guilty sentencing, they presented a case, the Department of Public Prosecution. So I've also been through court transcripts, police interviews with Bryant, the Seascape tapes, and most importantly, I went through the witness statements, and that's what I found is probably the most important tool for establishing what actually happened that day.
Yeah, well, I've actually spoken to somebody who was in the cafe during the shooting, and she has stated quite categorically that the shooter was not Bryant. He had short hair and seemed to be rather military in appearance. So. Yes. These witness statements, yeah, I think you're right. They're a very, very important tool in establishing what's happened. But why do you think that the official story was put out in such a way that it looks like it's all a lie?
Well, I suppose in the whole sense, when I first started looking into why it happened, it was quite obvious that it was to do with the gun laws, to change the gun laws. So that was probably the major reason. So,
so in other words, you think this was a setup to take away our guns?
No doubts at all. No doubts at all. There's a lot more. Obviously, we haven't got time to discuss it, and there's been a lot of information already presented by other presenters. But, yeah, so basically, whatever the DPP formed an official narrative accusing Bryant of everything. And whatever official narrative wasn't included. For example, Wendy Spur, she received a letter suggesting that her evidence wasn't required to be used in court, when, in fact, she was one of the most qualified witnesses of anyone there on the day.
Well, she was the lady... She was the lady in the cafe.
Yes, that's correct.
That's the one I spoke to.
Best qualified witness of anyone. Yes, they did not want to use her evidence. Why? well, we can only suggest, allude to why.
All right, let's go through some of the other witnesses. There was Laycock, Collier, Rook, and McKenna.
Yes, the Collier witness, the Collier one, is probably the most critical one. He was one of the ex-soldier who was wounded by the shooter. Now, what's incredible about his statement, that he describes the shooter wearing a khaki overcoat or duffel coat. The other thing that he clearly mentions is, being a soldier, he watched the guy pull an SLR out of the bag. Now, the SLR is another name for the FNAL weapon. Yes, it was allegedly used outside the cafe. And by the official narrative, it was the AR-15 that was used inside the cafe. But this ex-soldier has clearly seen the guy pull out an SLR that was a lightly painted colour. It's a very clear description. What's also interesting is another bloke who was wounded at the time, a guy called Mike Sargent. Mike Sargent describes this shooter as having a blue jacket on, a blue ski jacket, which matches witness descriptions given by McKenna and Beekman of a person in a blue jacket.
So were these two people in the same place at the same time?
Well, what it looks like, they were in the cafe at the same time. Sargent and Collier were both in the cafe. So Collier's saying he's had a khaki top on and an SLR gun. Sargent has said that he's actually had a blue jacket on. The interesting thing is, when the gunman with the blue jacket walked in, Mick Sargent and him had a skin. It was a very intense moment. And then by the witness statements, his girlfriend Kate has jumped in and asked a question. So when the gunman's got up and started shooting with the blue jacket, he's killed the two Asian people first. Next thing he's done, he's spun around to line up Mike Sargent. He's got a graze in the head, survived, but his wife unfortunately died. So it's this kind of contradictory evidence of two people in the cafe that is quite amazing.
Can you explain that? How come why are there two conflicting stories? Could it be that the witnesses were in different parts of the cafe?
That's what I believe has actually happened. You have to understand, in the time, the place was absolutely packed at lunchtime. There were 60-odd people estimated to be in the cafe.
Whoa.
It was that busy. They could be sitting on a table within maybe 3 or 4 metres of each other, and no one's actually going to work it out. When the shooting started, basically everyone's covered, put their head to the ground and just not even looking around, basically covering and fear for their life. There's another issue with the witness statement. There's a gentleman called Jim Laycock who used to own the Broad Arrow Cafe before it was sold to the Tasmanian government in mid-95. Laycock took over ownership of the Port Arthur Motel. He was the only witness that actually personally knew Martin Bryant. He witnessed the gunman kill Zoe Hall in the Corolla and abduct Glenn Pears and put him into the boot of the BMW. Yet Laycock did not name Bryant as the suspect, and he's the only one that actually knew him.
And did he describe the suspect?
Yes, I haven't got the description on me, but this fits in with the by this stage, it's looking like the gentleman that had the khaki top on has taken that off to a white top. Of a clear suggestion that a top's been taken off at one stage, because as he moves on down the road, and I've tracked the witness statements, the khaki top, khaki overcoat turns into a white bone jacket, under jacket. Going through the witness statements is a fellow called Jim Rook. He lived near the Seascape Cafe, was travelling down the road at the time of the incident towards the tip. Just got out of his house. He saw the BMW pull into the seascape. Now, he claims that he was shot at from about 20 feet away at a point-blank range. He actually says in his statements, "I thought they were using blanks." Now, he describes the gunman as having dark clothing mousy coloured short hair and a full beard.
Mm-hmm.
It's these kind, and there's no issue, there's no suggestion this bloke's had any reason to lie whatsoever. But this looks like the point of the incident where you have to separate maybe what happened at the cafe and what happened at the seascape are effectively two different things. So what I believe that the second part of the shooting is, or the second lot of gunmen, if you like, the shooters have taken over at the seascape.
Mm.
So yeah, some quite interesting things that actually do come up with the witness statements. So
Jamie, I think it's time to take a quick break. I'd like to play a song, which I think is rather appropriate at the moment, by Manfred Mann called Blinded by the Light. So we'll be back shortly.
Blinded by the light, wrapped up like a douche, another runner in the night. Blinded by the light, wrapped up like a douche, another runner in the night.
Show. This is your host, Mike Holt, and my guest today is Jamie, who's done a lot of research onto the Port Arthur slaughter. Jamie, before we listen to the song, you were talking about somebody with a beard, a guy called Rook, who was one of the witnesses there. I was a bit intrigued by this guy. Who is he again?
Rooks. He was approximately 50-year-old gentleman. He lived near Seascape. And in that afternoon, he had a trailer behind him. So he's virtually just come out of his house, driving down the road about 50, 60 kilometres an hour, when the BMWs pulled over into Seascape. The next thing he's noticed, someone's come out and shot at him from about 20 feet away, to the point where in the statement, he actually thought the blanks were being shot at him, that there was no window smashing or anything.
That's right.
And he actually clearly stated that the guy had short hair, short mousy hair, and a full beard, which is quite interesting. The other very interesting thing about that point, about the Rook witness, is that the Crown or the Department of Prosecution, part of his witness statement in their overall official narrative. But what they left out of it was the fact that the shooter that he described had short hair and a mouthy beard. And he described him as being very short, to the point where he's only just not much taller than the BMW. So I find the fact that the prosecution used part of his witness statement but left out such a key component is, to me personally, quite conclusive. They just picked what they needed and they fitted what they needed into the official narration. And I find it quite incredible that they didn't mention that the guy that shot at him had a beard and short hair.
Well, there's seems to be a lot of inconsistencies in this story from the official side. And
incredible, incredible inconsistencies. The whole Seascape affair, the fact there was two shooters there, it's been Martin Bryant, or if it was Martin Bryant, on the phone, talking to McCarthy, the police negotiator. There's 20 costs recorded in that time. When someone tested it, there's definitely gunshots coming from, sort of sounds like, upstairs. So, and really the whole, when you go through and analyse the whole incident at Seascape, it is nothing short of bizarre.
Did you say 20 coughs?
Yes, there's 20, you can actually go through, anyone can go and get it on the internet, it's available, and there's also court transcripts of it, but in the transcripts they say there's cough, cough, cough.
Mm.
Every shot that's being fired is considered to be a cough, which is another one of those adds to the... I mean, when I've gone through over the last couple of months and there's literally hundreds and hundreds of little discrepancies like that. One thing I noticed from Sunday night, the John Avery is the lawyer.
Mm.
Now, when Martin Bryant first went to court and pleaded not guilty, there was a huge uproar. The lawyer was sacked, and John Avery, who actually worked for the prosecution, then went and defended Martin. Avery's own, as he admits, his only only thing he was trying to achieve was a guilty plea. Because if it had gone to court, there's so many inconsistencies and statements in that, he probably knows, but they did not want a court case.
Well, who appointed him? Surely Brian didn't appoint him.
No, Brian didn't appoint. I'm not sure who officially appointed. See, Brian had his own lawyers that he used to deal with through his financial estate and that.
Mm.
But when he was that lawyer was not appointed to him at the start. I'm not sure of the name of the first lawyer off the top of my head. Yeah, but basically, when Brian pleaded not guilty, that lawyer got kicked out, and then Avery came onto the case.
Dear me, that's a very bad inconsistency for a start.
It's quite shocking, yes. I'm quite glad. When I was watching the episode the other night, I knew that he'd gone to jail for fraud. And I'm sitting here going, how? And eventually, yes, it does come out towards the show that he admits that, you know, he embezzled $500,000 and went to jail for 4 years. So, yeah, it's quite interesting.
That should have disqualified him for a start. Was that before the massacre?
No, this was... So when he got charged with fraud, that was well after the massacre.
Oh, I see.
It was part of, and you almost see the other night, he's attributing his financial, his addiction to art and stuff like that through the stress of know, what he went through in defending Brian. So,
dear me. Yeah. What about poor old Brian, what he went through?
Well, that's the thing. He's, in one way, his low IQ of 66 and virtually the equivalent of an 11-year-old man boy is probably the only way that he could actually deal with being in prison. I think anyone in that situation wouldn't have been able to handle it. I think his simple nature allowed him to actually deal with that situation inside better than what a more intelligent person or emotional person would have.
You know, I was watching that Sunday night show, and I was very intrigued by the police interview because, first of all, it was quite obvious that they were bringing up loaded and leading questions. And Bryant, actually, when you watch what he was answering, not once did he actually admit to anything.
Yeah, it's quite obvious that he's very confused and he doesn't seem to know what's going on. And he's asking, you know, how many people got shot, how many people got injured, you know, because he genuinely, I believe, he does not know. That's why even when he's looking through the photos, there's no indication that he's done it. So, and one thing I found intriguing was when he apparently confessed by saying, "Oh, it's me," when the camera was off. That I did not take that as a sign of guilt at all. I took that as an 11-year-old man boy being a bit of a smart aleck to it, like as if to say, "Oh, you think it's me, do you?" Or in a sense, he's just starting to dawn. Click on, "Oh, you think it's me?"
Yeah, I got that sense too. I mean, I'm a fairly good, you know, I can read people pretty well, and I didn't see any sign of guilt in his statements at all.
And it's an interesting aspect of the case is Brian admits to in the interview. So he actually admits to taking the BMW, and he puts a hostage in there. But it doesn't relate anything to at all to the actual incident of where the hostage was taken at outside with Zoe Hall and Glenn Pierce.
All right, can you explain that a bit better? Because I don't know what you're talking about, and I'm sure some of our listeners don't either.
Right, it's a little bit to explain. Brian admits the only thing he actually admits to is kidnapping, taking the hostage at the Fortescue Bay turnoff. In the car, there's apparently a guy, husband and wife, and a child in the back. And as he states, he's basically there on the side of the road and pulls the car over and says, "I want to take the car." And what he says, he actually, the girl and the daughter drive away in the Volvo.
Was the Volvo the one he was driving, was it?
That's the only thing he's admitted to, but that is not what happened at all. He was originally in the Volvo. So the official narrative is that, at the toll booth, when the gunman was driving out, he's taken the Volvo, the BMW at the toll booth. He's had an argument. He shot the four people in the BMW.
Was he driving the Volvo?
He was earlier in the day, but I don't believe it was Martin Bryant driving out of the Port Arthur, out towards the toll booth. I believe that was the actual gunman.
I'm confused here because how did that Volvo get to be where he supposedly kidnapped this couple and drove off in a BMW?
This is one of the absolutely bizarre things that he's admitted to something that has not officially happened. So we can only allude to what was going on in Martin's mind, why he'd even suggest that he take a BMW, whether he was coerced somehow into making that statement. But the fact is, officially, the BMW was taken over at the toll booth, and the four occupants in the BMW were killed. It doesn't relate anything to the actual story that Brian suggests, that he's taken the BMW at Fortescue Bay turnoff, which is approximately 3 kilometres on the other side of Seascape. So probably needs a lot more explanation to try and explain it quickly so I can understand a bit of confusion. It certainly taken me a while to understand everything myself. So
We'll have a break now because I'm going to read a verse from the Quran. So we'll be back in a couple of minutes. Each week, we read a verse from the Quran to try and understand how Islam thinks. This week we're reading Surah 9, paragraph 29. It reads, "Fight those who believe not in Allah, nor the last day, nor hold that forbidden which has been forbidden by Allah and His Messenger, nor acknowledge the religion of truth, even if they are of the people of the book, until they pay the jizya with willing submission and feel themselves subdued." Now in this passage, people of the book refers to Christians and Jews. According to this verse, they are to be violently subjugated, with the sole justification being their religious status. These are the only two religions that Islam actually acknowledges. All followers of other religions are to be killed out of hand. This chapter was one of the final revelations from Allah, and it set in motion the tenacious military expansion in which Muhammad's companions managed to conquer two-thirds of the Christian world in the next 100 years. Islam is intended to dominate all other people and faiths, and this is why we must resist the Islamization of our nations. Welcome back to the Gotcha Radio Show with your host, Mike Holt. And we've just heard there about the Quran, with 109 verses in the Quran telling Muslims that they must either convert or kill us and kill all the Jews. We believe that there is no place in Australia for Islam. There is just no place at all in it. And therefore, if Restore Australia is elected to Parliament, we will get a law through to ban the Quran, and from that, Islam will not be able to exist in Australia. It's totally diametrically opposed to everything that we stand for. Now, in the studio here with me, I have Jamie, who has been telling us about the events at Port Arthur. Jamie, we both watched the TV program on Sunday. Can you tell us what your thoughts on that are?
How you going there? Yes, I was just explaining before investigating a conspiracy theory, if you like, of a father and two sons being involved. Now, this theory was developed through the extensive investigations of someone I'd like to acknowledge, is our Stuart K. Beattie. Now, he was the one that actually suggested that the father was the man in the white gumboots that we saw on the video the other night. Now, as the investigator states, this gentleman probably would have slipped through the radar of his investigations, but he analysed all the witness statements, and there was two witnesses, Wendy Spur, as we've mentioned, we've touched on before, right, and another nurse in there called Joanne Moores, who mentioned this particular individual in their statements. They were extremely concerned and suspicious by his behaviour in the cafe.
Right.
He was seen attending to bodies, as in not so much checking for vital signs, but seemed to be rifling through the bodies and information or IDs and stuff like that. Now, this was noted by Joanne Moores, and she concluded that in her investigations, in a witness statement to police, that she was very concerned about this particular gentleman's behaviour. So this led the Mr. Beattie to investigate this individual. What it was discovered that this gumboot man was 2 weeks after the massacre, he was in the Who Weekly magazine. He stated at the time he was 200 metres away from the cafe with his son, and his other son ran past and said, "Dad, Dad, people are shooting." And from the video on Sunday night, it's clearly established that he's not 200 metres away. He's actually on the balcony at the time. Now, this gentleman also won a bravery citation. In the bravery citation, he's lied again. He actually states that he's in the car park at the time with his two sons. Again, the video proves quite conclusively that he's on the balcony at the time. Now, what's interesting, he is also seen in a number of videos, the father, but in no videos at all are the sons seen. They're not around him at all, against what he suggested.
Hmm.
So that was very, very curious sort of thing. Now, he won a bravery award, but the sons did not receive any bravery awards at all. He alleges they were helping victims as well. The father received a compensation claim. The sons didn't receive any compensation claim at all. So it's quite interesting. Now, this gentleman, when the first ambulance arrived, about 3:07 p.m., the first person that was taken out onto the ambulance was actually a 15-year-old dead girl. And she was covered over with a blanket. Now, I find that quite incredible on my own, when there's injured people around, that was actually a dead girl that was taken out and she was covered over.
Yeah.
Now, this guy in the gumboots ferried the victim on the stretcher. They went into the helicopter. The gentleman in the gumboots was the last person seen coming out of the helicopter and closing the door.
Right.
Which I found quite interesting.
But no sign of the sons?
No sign of the sons at all. Now, it's interesting, the sons' ages at the time were apparently 20 and 17, which, coincidence or not, but it seems to match the majority's descriptions of the age of the gunman.
Mm.
Now, yesterday I mentioned to you that it was clearly established through witness statements that one gentleman was shot at by a guy in a khaki top, and another guy was shot at by a bloke in a blue ski jacket.
Right.
Multiple accounts of two different victims, two different types of gunmen.
Mm.
Now, we know that one of the gunmen left the cafe, shot at buses, took over the BMW and went to Seascape. So it sort of made me think, if there was a blue jacket and a khaki jacket gunman, we know that one of them left the cafe and went on.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, where was the other? How did the other gunman get away? So what I'm actually alluding to, I believe, as I said, I find it highly ironic, highly suspicious. The first victim was a dead person who was covered up, and I find it ironic that the father was the last person out of the helicopter, which led me to possibly conclude that under that blanket, beside the 15-year-old girl, by all, I mean, I can't say 100%, but by my investigations, and it's a logical conclusion to suggest, without being able to prove it definitively, that yes, there may be more to why that dead girl was taken out. In other videos of the helicopter, there's wounded victims. You know, you can see blood. They're not covered over. They're being put into the helicopter. So, yeah, very interesting that,
I didn't notice anything, but that first stretcher, did it look inordinately heavy?
Well, I'm not sort of sure. I need to probably have a look back and analyse that. There was about four people carrying it.
Mm.
But in the video, you can quite clearly see that he's the last one out of the helicopter and closes the door.
Mm.
So it sort of led me to run down that path as well. That's maybe how the second gunman that we can confirm may have left the site.
Okay, look, Jamie, we're going to have to take another break here because I've got Mighty Mo standing at the tent door and he wants to come in and play havoc with us. So let's take a...
Then not argue with him then.
No, let's take a quick break and I'll get back to you very shortly.
Mighty Mo!
Negotiations between Mighty Mo and Foster Foskin were in dire straits the last time we listened in. Poor Mighty Mo and his hordes of Muslims had made a heart-wrenching discovery. Mighty Mo could never handle a drink of alcohol. After all, he's never heard of self-control. So he just banned it. Instead, he ordered his Muslim followers to drink chocolate. But now they have found out that it contains porcine DNA.
And it's all that dastardly Australian's fault, Foster Foskin. Peace be upon his name. Hey, Mo, what wears a turban and squeals like a stuck pig? No, don't answer. I'll answer for you. It's a chocolate-eating, turban-wearing, fornicating, little child-loving Muslim. Ah, you thought you were going to take over Australia with your Islamic-laced dates? Dream on, you cursed piglet. Damn you to the seven levels of hell, you infidel. Look at me. I'm growing a curly tail. My ears are getting longer. My nose is turning into a snout. Ah, no worries, mate. It suits you. You've always been a bit of a pig anyway, with your snout stuck in anything that gives you pleasure. Well, now the boot's on the other foot. It's too late for you, fool. Sending all your Muslim followers to invade our lands by stealth is coming back to bite you on the bum. Or should I call it bacon now?
We will not give up. Even now, my followers are building mosques all over your land. We will take over Australia. You can be sure of that, on the beard of our stone-hearted god Allah.
Ah, dream on, mate. If Angola can ban your crazy ideology and tear down your mosques, and if Sri Lanka can ban your insulting halal certification, what do you reckon us Aussie battlers are going to do? We outnumber you dozens to one. And when I get back home, I'm going to make sure everyone knows about your crazy dream to take over our beautiful land. I've got people driving around Bendigo right now playing this at 5 a.m. just to wake people up to your nasty designs.
Allahu Akbar.
You want to wake up to Allah's call to prayer for the rest of your life, support the mosque for Bendigo.
You can't play that. The people will wake up and get angry with you.
I doubt it. Not once they understand what you plan for their poor city. Hey Mo, you Muslims can't handle what we're going to dish out to you. Why, you can't even get on with each other.
Rubbish. We are all united by me, Mighty Mo, the last prophet, by our beautiful Quran that I haven't written yet, but someone will in a few hundred years after I die and go to paradise.
Ring the bells of heaven, there is joy today, for us all returning from the wild.
United? I'll tell you how united you all are. You can't even agree on your stupid religion. How do you tell a sunny from a shite?
How do I tell a sunny from a shite?
Yeah, you don't have to. There's no sunnies left. They've had the shite blown out of them.
That's not funny.
No, Mo? Then how about this? What do I call you when you get drunk? Wait for it. Wait for it. Mohammed!
Yes!
I don't drink. How dare you?
No, you don't drink. Too hard to keep it under your turban, isn't it? Hey, listen, Mo. I heard yous are afraid to give your kids sex education and driving lessons on the same day, in case yous wear out the camel.
Filthy infidel! I will kill you!
Hey, Mighty Mo. Oink, oink. How's that porcine DNA coursing through your system? Oh dear. Foster is really walking a fine line there, isn't he? But isn't it time we all stop excusing the inexcusable and start pointing out the truth about Mohammedism? The Muslims have told enough lies. Foster is leading the way. But what else can he do to show Mighty Mo how deluded he is? Find out next week. And tune in for more adventures of
Mighty Mo!
Well, Mighty Mo continues to cause havoc, and you never know quite what he's going to get up to, but he's a lot of fun, and I hope he also helps to educate people about the idiocy of Islam. Let's face it, it is. It's a very stupid ideology. All right, we're back on air on the Gotcha Radio Show with Jamie, and we've been discussing the Port Arthur massacre. Jamie, after hearing all of the results of your investigations, I've got to ask the question, do you believe that Martin Bryant is innocent or guilty?
100% innocent. I have personally no doubts whatsoever. There's so much evidence. But at the bottom end of the day, the main thing is he wasn't mentally, physically or psychologically capable of carrying out such an act.
Hang on a moment. I've got a question here for you. Because I think you mentioned when he pulled up the Volvo and took off in the, or he pulled up in the Volvo and took off in the BMW, didn't he kill two people there?
Probably needs a lot more explanation, but according to the official testimony, he stopped his Volvo at the toll booth, killed people in the BMW, and then took the BMW and continued on to just out the front of Port Arthur, where he's alleged to have kidnapped a person and put him in the back of the BMW.
Now, didn't that person who was kidnapped testify against and say that it wasn't him?
No, he died in the fire.
I see.
The gentleman was Glenn Pears. They were in a white Corolla. His girlfriend at the time, Zoe Hall, was actually shot. By the looks of the witness statements, he's tried to grab the girl, and then the guys, he's tried to grab Zoe, and then Glenn's jumped in and said, no, take me. Who's gone and put him in the boot and then shot Zoe Hall. This is what was witnessed by people inside the shop.
Okay, and did they see the shooter clearly?
Yes, they clearly saw the shooter. I think I mentioned yesterday there was a gentleman, Jim Laycock, who was the owner of the Port Arthur Motel,
right,
was the only individual that actually witnessed, that actually knew Martin Bryant personally.
Mm-hmm.
So he had quite a clear look at the gunman and could not describe it as Martin Bryant. There's so many intriguing aspects to the case that I could go on for days, but obviously we don't have that amount of time. And
not today.
People have probably got better things to do as well.
Yes, so you believe that Bryant is innocent.
Absolutely.
Okay.
No doubt.
So who is guilty, in your opinion?
In my opinion, like I said, this theory of a father and two sons, when you investigate it, with all the little conclusions I come to before, I think there is huge merit in those suggestions. I'm not sure if viewers or listeners are aware, but there was also a soldier seen leaving in an ambulance, the first ambulance. He was seen leaving in the front seat of the ambulance from the cafe. Now, he's on video in the front seat, and he was also videoed getting out of the ambulance to Hobart Hospital. Quite clearly, a person dressed in soldier's uniform.
I see.
So,
and
that needs explaining as well. So I firmly believe that there could have, by all evidence that I've looked at, there was two shooters, one in a blue ski jacket, one in a khaki duffel overcoat, and then this presence of a soldier also leads that he obviously was involved. So, yes, quite interesting case. Another probably unknown aspect of the case is after the shooting occurred, a mystery black van with Commonwealth number plates was spent about 2.5 hours outside the cafe. And it raises another question. What was a mystery black van with its windows covered with Commonwealth number plates doing there just after the incident?
Couldn't have been the investigators, would it?
No, there was It was quite interesting because the first detective did not arrive on the scene till about 4:30. And basically all he did was go to the Volvo, which was parked at the toll booth, and grab the passport, basically to ID Brian. His passport, conveniently, was left sitting on the dash. Quite interesting that you see a lot of the shootings around the world, all these gunmen seem to leave their passports lying around to identify themselves, which I find a little bit ironic. So.
Okay, I think we'd better take another music break because this, I'm sure we all need time to digest all of this. But when you get back, I'll ask you to sum up what your findings have been. So we'll listen now to a song by Brian Ferry, "Smoke Gets in Your Eyes."
They ask me how I view my true love was true. I of course replied, something here inside cannot be denied. Someday you'll find all who love are blind. Ooh, ooh. When your heart's on fire, you must be alive. Smoke gets in your eyes. So by chance, and I gained the land to think they could doubt.
Investigation into the Port Arthur incident, and Jamie, it's pretty obvious from what you've been saying that Martin Bryant has been set up as a patsy. From your investigations, and also from mine, and also from other people that I've spoken to, it's quite clear that the whole thing is a setup designed to allow the government to take our guns, and of course. We're starting to see the results of that silly policy now. We have very many highly armed criminals. Our policemen are not capable of fighting back effectively. The general population is at the media show that we did, that the Grand Mufti of Australia, the guy who's in charge of the Islamic Council of Australia, actually controls 80,000 Islamic security guards who are all armed, some of them with automatic weapons. And this is a very worrying scenario because We all know what's going to happen. One day Islam is going to turn on us, just as it's turned on other countries. And yesterday I saw a very worrying statistic that the actual population of Islamists in Australia is not the 2.2% that was current at the time of the last census. We believe that it's somewhere between 4 to 6% of our population now. And we know that once the Islamic population gets to 4 or 5%, we start seeing exactly the problems that we've started seeing here. The terrorist attacks, the undermining of our institutions, building more mosques, spreading the tentacles of Islam into every facet of our society. That is happening at an accelerated rate. We have people paying, everybody in Australia now is paying a halal certification tax to Islam, and that that trade is purported to be in the billions of dollars per year. And we know overall around the world last year it was $2.8 trillion worth of business going to the halal certification business. And halal certification is nothing but a scam. So we are under direct attack, and this Port Arthur massacre was really the thin end of the wedge. Things had been happening before this, but by taking away our guns, it opened up the doors for the Muslims to really start attacking our institutions. And they've been very smart about it. They haven't actually done too many physical attacks yet, although we're expecting that. But they have undermined our institutions, and we are in dire straits now. Many Australians are getting worried about it, but not enough. How long do we have to wait before enough Australians wake up and realise we have let the snake into our chest? So you believe that Martin Bryant is innocent. So what do you think we could do about this, Jamie?
Well, it's an interesting thing, and in what you've turned, it's very relevant points you've brought up before. I believe, in a sense, the whole, it was a part of controlling the guns, and it come from a greater UN directive, which relates to, if anyone's heard information about Agenda 21, which we may not have time to elaborate on. People may like to investigate that from cells, but it's all leading. So I believe that a terrorist attack in Australia is inevitable.
It's imminent.
Yes. One of the interesting things about the Tasmania case is when you go back through, certain politicians, even in the months leading up to it, were making very bizarre statements. This gentleman was quoted a couple of times saying, if we don't get gun control reform, we're going to see a massacre in Tasmania. It's almost like they were hinting it was all part of this. So much more evidence relating to things that people have said. I think it started in 1987 where Barry Unsworth, I think he was the New South Wales Premier, at a Premier's meeting, he was the first one to say, if we don't get gun control, there's going to be a massacre in Tasmania.
I've seen that report too, and it's a very worrying report, because how would they know this? You know, are they prescient? Do they know something, or did they know something?
Yes. And the benefit we have of looking back, it's 20 years now since the incident, we have the benefit of the hindsight to looking back at those statements in 1987. A lot of statements in 1996. The whole fact that the Broad Arrow Cafe was actually purchased by the government in mid-95 and renovated. Now, this is unusual because it did come at a time when privatisation was occurring quite in the government, Telecom and Telstra. So it was unusual that the government actually bought the cafe in mid-95.
What would they be doing with a cafe? I mean, I can understand something like Telstra, but a cafe? It just doesn't make sense, does it?
No, it doesn't make sense. Another thing about it, I'm not sure, the Premier of Tasmania at the time was Ray Groom. Now, he actually, in very controversial circumstances, resigned from being the Premier 6 weeks before the incident.
Mm-hmm.
He took up all the portfolios and controlled the portfolios relating to the Port Arthur tourism and the associated files with that. So it's interesting, the benefit of the hindsight is a lot There's also, I'm not sure if you're aware, a mortuary truck that was ordered, a 22-capacity mortuary truck, which was ordered in around 95. That came at a time when I think the massacres in deaths in Tasmania was something like one or two a month.
Right.
So there's absolutely no logical reason. Further investigation also reveals that an embalming unit, which embalms the bodies, that was also made up and pre-ordered for the event. And in statements have come out that how convenient and how amazing that we had this equipment.
Do you have anything else you'd like to add before we end up the show?
Well, pretty well, just some made most of the summaries. I suppose there's going to be a day at the 20th anniversary on the Port Arthur. There's a memorial and a service going to be held on that day.
Right. You mentioned something about being there for that.
Well, I would like to be there. I'm not sure how feasible it is, but to be there as a form of protest against what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But I've said it's very going to be a very sensitive day for the victims, and it's one of those things that always gets brought up. If someone tries to go and against the official story, they're sullying the memories of the victims, they're being insensitive. Now, how could you do that? You know, people are mourning, you don't make it worse for them. The event as a false flag event, as a PSYOP or psychological operation, terror operation, achieved its effect perfectly.
It did.
Even now, you're still, apparently in Tasmania, you're still something you can't talk about. You're not allowed to talk about it in the Port Arthur tours. So, yeah, it's all very interesting. So,
what happened to freedom of speech?
What's freedom of speech?
Yes, exactly. Well, we had a very interesting example of that the other day. We went to a Meet the Candidates meeting in Butterim up here on the Sunshine Coast, which was run by a left-wing group called the Buddies for Refugees. And, of course, they want to bring in all of these refugees who are sitting up on Manus Island and Nauru, etc. And now, for a Meet the Candidates meeting, you would think that they would want to hear questions from the floor, wouldn't you? But no, we were all told to shut up, listen, and they would field questions that were already pre-submitted by the buddies. It was a farce. It was a real farce. But this is the trouble with the socialists. They don't believe in democracy any more than the Muslims do, and any more than the communists do. And let's face it, the socialism is just soft communism. So these are the people that we have to fight against, that we are trying to protect our democracy from, because these people do not believe in democracy, they do not believe in freedom of speech, and that's why we are in this fight. So, Jamie, I would like to thank you very much for coming on the show. You've certainly opened my eyes to a lot of facts that I was unaware of, and confirmed a few that I did know. And, of course, as I said, I've spoken to one of the victims, and she's confirmed a lot of what you have said. So, I personally...
She's an amazing lady.
Yes, she is, and I had quite a long discussion with her a while back. I must recontact her, actually, because perhaps she would have something to say about all of this. But... I want to thank you for coming on the show, and I hope that our listeners have enjoyed it and got something worthwhile from it. So, Jamie, thank you very much, and goodbye
Mike,
for now.
Mike, I'd like to thank you for giving me this opportunity. It's my first foray into speaking on a public forum about this, and I appreciate the opportunity so much.
No worries. I blindsided you a bit there, didn't I?
If anyone did want to contact me or have any relevant information or questions, they can contact me. I've got an email address. It's pillarsoftruth101@gmail.com. So pillars is PILLARSOFTURUTH. So pillarsoftruth101@gmail.com.
Excellent. That's great. Yes. and I suspect you might have a few people asking you more questions. Certainly when I posted this topic on my Facebook page the other day, it generated a tremendous amount of discussion. So people are obviously still very concerned about the Port Arthur massacre. So let's keep asking questions. We must hold our government responsible and accountable.
In the last couple of days, actually, when you mentioned about, I've spent a lot of time talking with people on the website, exchanging information and ideas. So thank you for your forum, and you do a wonderful job. So continue the good work, Mike.
Thanks, Jamie. I'll see you again. Bye now. This is the Gotcha Radio Show with your host, Mike Holt, signing off until next week. And Australia, beware. Islam is here. Islam intends to take over. Don't let them.